Morning, everyone. Good to be with you again. So as Maura said yesterday, and I've tried to make both seminars kind of stand alone in many ways, obviously, but they do also dovetail together. But yesterday, as we thought about this topic of repurpose, discovering fresh purpose in retirement, we recognized that retirement as a word or even as a concept is not biblical. But we recognize that there is this season of our lives, that latter season of our lives. And today we're thinking about, or continue to think about this theme under the title Vocation or Vacation, God's Retirement Plan for My Life. Yesterday I spoke a bit about the need for us to look into the rear view mirror and to see what skills, what experiences that we bring into this season of our lives. And we asked that question towards the end of the seminar, what is it we have in our hands? And sometimes we can feel like, I don't have an awful lot, but whatever we have, we can offer, and God can use it. Looking in the rearview mirror is something my mother should have done a couple of weeks when reversing off the drive of her house with my dad in the passenger seat. As she reversed off the drive, she went straight into a bus. Fortunately, the bus was stationary at the bus stop opposite where they live, but Mum managed to reverse straight across. When I spoke to her about it on the phone, she said, well, it wasn't there when I got in the car. And my dad, oh, if I could introduce you to my dad, is the most placid person. He's in his early 80s. And he said, Steve, he said, I don't think I've ever heard my father use bad language throughout his life. He barely does. But he couldn't even bring himself to tell me what he said. But he said, I let out two BHs. Well, it took me about 10 minutes to work out what you're going to think about, isn't it? Like, you're going to be, don't pretend you don't know any bad words. Anyway, she really should have looked in the rear view mirror. She was absolutely fine, and the bus driver was very kind to her and encouraged her to go in for a cup of tea, but that's how it was for her. Bless her. A few months ago, I was on a flight, and I watched this film, Naiad. Has anybody seen this film, Naiad? Nobody? Oh, you should see it. It's a wonderful film. Annette Bening plays a particular character, and Jodie Foster. And the film tells the story, the true story, of a lady called Diana Nyad and the multiple attempts that she made to swim the Straits of Florida. So you can swim from Cuba to the Florida Keys. It's 110 miles. I wonder how far you can swim. I recently got my 25-meter Kellogg's swimming badge that I'll put on my trunk. No, I can swim a little bit further than that. But here's the extraordinary thing. Diana Nyad was 64 years old when she made her fifth and successful attempt to swim the Straits. 64 years old. During the crossing, she faced seasickness, shark attacks, disturbing hallucinations. She swam for 53 hours without being able to get out of the water. You can't exit the water if you're going to attempt it. Diana Nyad had attempted the crossing 30 years earlier as a younger lady. And at one point in the film, she makes the suggestion is made that the one thing that inspired her to try again at the age of 64 was a poem by Mary Oliver called The Summer Day. You may know it. And it contains this line. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And Diana Nyad is gripped by this and doesn't want to waste her one wild, precious life. And so she dives headlong into this almost impossible challenge. Now, before you panic this morning, I am not about to suggest that we should all go away from here and leave Keswick. There are some challenges around here, aren't there? There's some of the hills or mountains or whatever that there are to climb. Even some people in the room, when I said that I had attempted Catbells, they referred to it as modest. I can't work out why I was sweating so much trying to get up the thing when it's only a modest climb. But anyway, there are some challenges around. But I'm not about to suggest that we all leave here and try and conquer Everest on Monday morning. But as we come into what John Wyatt in his book, he calls his books entitled The Final Lap, we face not just one challenge. He says we face three transitions. And he talks about the transition that we face. I'm not going to dive into these, but just acknowledging different transitions. We spoke about those yesterday. He talks about how we transition from paid work into retirement. We transition from independence into dependence. We transition, that final transition, he talks about our transition from life to death. And John ends his book acknowledging that when we consider the race that we've run, that there are ups and downs. We may feel a sense of regret as we look back and as we look in the rearview mirror. We may look in that rearview mirror and feel a sense of failure. We may feel wounded as we look back on the seasons of our lives. But he summarizes in this way. He says, the good cannot be lost. The evil can be redeemed, and the best is yet to come. I always remember hearing of a lady, I spoke about this at a funeral once, and she asked that in her coffin, they put a fork in with her in her coffin. And when asked why she wanted this, she said, because her mother always told her to keep a fork because the best was yet to come. As we transition into this season of our lives, as with any transition, the key questions we face that we'll dip into today are these questions of who am I now, where am I now, and what do I do now? William Bridges, in his book, Making Sense of Life's Changes, and we mentioned this briefly yesterday, he says that transition are a process of disorientation and reorientation that marks the turning points of growth and self-renewal. I was speaking to one or two of you afterwards, and you were talking about how that transition has been and how perhaps some suggest that it can take 4 or 5 years to make that transition and find those new rhythms and understand now who I am in this particular season. But that recognition that it's not just a click of the fingers and all changes and we find ourselves in a great new place. So let's think about the first one of those, our identity. Now that I'm retired, or as I approach this season, now that I'm retired, who am I? Have you ever noticed that when people ask us what we do, we tell them who we are? When asked what we do, we respond by telling them who we are. So when we meet somebody at a wedding or a dinner or something or a local park and they ask us, well, what do you do? We don't usually say, I do nursing, or I do parenting. We give them an I am answer. I am a nurse. I am a pastor. I am a full-time parent. I'm a civil engineer. They ask us a question about our function, and we instinctively tell them something about our identity. They ask what, but we respond with a who. Back when we were 21, someone's trying to remember that, when we were 21 years old, we probably explored identity questions with a fair amount of enthusiasm and energy. What am I going to give my life to? What am I going to do with my life? Who am I now? Who might I become? When we enter into our later years and we hang up our proverbial boots, as it were, many of us find these identity questions resurfacing for us. For some of us, that may be exciting. It's a season of opportunity, of possibility, of exploration. But for others, it can be daunting or disorientating, even depressing. Now that I'm retired, who am I and who might I become? Meet Charles. In his book, This Is Our Time, author Trevin Wex tells the story of Charles M. Schulz, the creator of the Peanuts cartoons, which feature the iconic Charlie Brown and Lucy Linus as well, of course, and of course, Snoopy the dog. Just a little cartoon I found that there was with Snoopy. It says about retirement. He says, I don't want to, I don't have to, you can't make me, I'm retired. Maybe you've adopted that attitude already. I don't know in terms of who you are. Every day for 50 years, a new cartoon strip appeared that Charles created, each dreamt up and sketched out by Schultz. Tragically, though, cancer brought Schultz face to face with retirement sooner than he was ready for. As Wax wrote his book, he explains how Schultz vacillated between feelings of anger and despair. In an interview near the end of his life, Schultz lamented having to lay down this iconic cartoon series before he was ready. He said this, I never dreamt this is what would happen to me. All of a sudden, it's gone. It's been taken away from me. I did not take this away from me. It was taken away from me. A close friend of the cartoonist shared how Schultz was not able to lay down his work graciously. Reflecting on Schultz's life, his biographer, David Michaelis, made this observation. He said, to the very end, his life had been inseparable from his art. In the moment of ceasing to be a cartoonist, he ceased to be. We often, in this transition moment, we struggle with our identity issues. In fact, we might feel like we've experienced, in some ways, an identity theft. For men, we know from the book of Genesis that we generally get our sense of identity from our work, whatever that might be. So when that work changes, a lot of men really struggle with, well, who am I now? They say, and this is very broad brushstroke and maybe not politically correct, but for ladies, if they get their identity from their relationship, if they lose their husband, if they're in a relationship at that stage of life, it can be a huge identity crisis. Well, who am I now? All sorts of things affect, don't they, our sense of identity. To at least some extent, people's identities have always been linked with the jobs that they do. Many British surnames are based on the kind of work done by earlier generations. Think about Cook or Smith or Weaver. Even in the Bible, people are referred to by the work that they do or an ability they have. Luke, the doctor. Lydia, the purple cloth trader. King David, Anna, the prophetess. And at least to some extent, it's inevitable that our identity gets linked to what we do. But for the people of God, if we are going to live out our changing roles and identities well, whether that's as a grandparent or a board member of a charity, as a carer, as a volunteer, or whatever we end up doing, it will help us tremendously if we are secure in our ultimate identity. In both the Old and the New Testaments, the biblical authors are always trying to help the people of God grasp their identity in light of who God is and what he's done for us. I think throughout life, we're always searching for our identity and our sense of value in other places. As a young preacher, I had a mentor, and he noticed a pattern in my life that I would constantly, when I went to be with him, and I'd talk, he'd ask me about how my preaching was going or how Sunday was, and he'd say, I've noticed a pattern for you, Steve. You either say to me, Sunday was amazing, I was so encouraged, people said such kind things about the way I preached today, or they said nothing, and I thought I'd preached an amazing message. He said, Steve, what I notice is you're constantly repeating a cycle. If you're encouraged or if you're not encouraged, you'll hit a wall every week and you go back again to next week and think, can I repeat it again? Will they laugh at my jokes tomorrow? I haven't got another joke about senility. Will they laugh again? And I feel like I've got to I shared that joke yesterday. One person laughed and I'm right. The rest of you didn't even remember, did you? Anyway. But you have to keep on repeating it, whichever way it is. Stevie said, You have to discover that your true sense of self-worth, of value, your identity is who you are in God. Exodus 19, 1-8. On the first day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did in Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. New Testament, 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10. Peter tells the people there, again, a people that find themselves in exile. In exile, you find yourself in a place where you're wondering, who am I? Where am I? What are we to do here? Peter says to them, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." The identity that God gives us is enduring. Whilst we may feel a certain way, or whilst the culture around us may make us feel that our identity is threatened or it's taken away from us in some ways, what God says about us is always true. A journey through life might take us from infant to student, to apprentice, to worker, to manager, to semi-retired, to retired. Yet through every stage, we are God's dearly loved children, his royal priests. And I would dare to say that the church in many ways has messed up our minds in terms of the thinking around that. They refer to someone like me who works as a Baptist minister. You're the priest. It's you that represents God to us and to the world around. And I think it's not what the scriptures say. We're a community of priests. We all, in the different places that we find ourselves, in terms of who we are, we're all priests. We all represent God to those around us. Adam and Eve, their role was priestly, not just in representing God. They represented the image that was built within them in the way that they cultivated life, in the way that they related and so on and so forth. Knowing that you're a priest, it will change you. I don't tend to wear a clerical collar as a Baptist minister, but a student of mine wanted to do an experiment for 2 weeks while he was with us in our church. And so for 2 weeks, we wore a collar as we went out into the town and went about the things that we did. It really changes how you drive your car. It really makes you conscious of what's in your shopping basket in the supermarket. It really makes you think about everything. But we're all priests. We represent God to our neighbors and the places where we go, at the golf club, the tennis club, wherever we find ourselves. We represent God to others. So just in a pause moment for yourself to think, having heard those things, how would you describe your God-given identity in your own words? Just ponder it for a moment. Having heard that, and you may wrestle with it. No matter what age we are, we can struggle with this, can't we? We're not who others say we are. We're not who we say we are, because sometimes we have that record playing in our minds that it's affected by the hurts and hang-ups and habits of our past. Ultimately, we are who God says we are. And he says that you are dearly loved. You are chosen. He knows who you are, and he knows where you are, and he knows what he has to do with you. And you are part of that community of priests, our identity. Oh, I should have been clicking slides. I can see that. Look at that. Let's think about where we are. LICC, we have this phrase that helps people to think about the significance of where they are in their everyday. We refer to people's frontline context. Our frontline context are the places where we live, the places where we work, and that's not necessarily our paid employment. It's where we carry out our daily activity, where we work, where our young people study, or where we play, where we spend our leisure time, those places that we show up to. So now that I'm retired, where am I? Many disciples in this moment of life have been formed to believe that they are only fruitful when serving on a church rota. They find it harder to identify their front lines, and they often lack imagination for what that could look like. A lot of people will approach retirement. I watch my parents do this in some ways, where they think, now finally I can dedicate myself to God and to the church. And what they mean by that is, now I can finally, I've got time to volunteer at the church. We tried yesterday, I just showed just those images of those dots and how that we are the church all of the time, Monday to Sunday. But because church has become very Sunday-centric and very building-centric and very clergy-centric, the way we think about church is that thing we go to do when we get together on a Sunday. We don't think in the way we talk about the culture of church that we are the church all the time, Monday to Sunday. Right now, I know we're here, but some of your friends from your church, they're out in those places where they live, where they work, where they study, where they play, being the church. Where am I now? The Bible encourages us to take notes of where we are, that we are there by God's foreknowledge and his plan in all sorts of different places. So I'm just trying to see whether I got that verse, if not. Jeremiah 29:7. It says, also seek the peace and the prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Or from 1 Peter. Peter writing to these Turkish Christians, he says, to God's elect, exiles scattered throughout the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying the work of the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and sprinkled with his blood, grace and peace be yours in abundance. In both those contexts, Jeremiah and 1 Peter, the people find themselves in exile, in a place where they feel like we're the wrong people, at the wrong time, in the wrong place. We shouldn't be here. And yet the text implies that you are there by God's foreknowledge. He knew you would be there for his purpose. Sometimes we can feel like, I'm living in the wrong place, I'm in the wrong house, or I'm in the wrong job, or sometimes in the wrong relationship we might feel, or I'm in the wrong, whatever it might be. But could it be? Could it be that God has you where you are, in the street where you are, as part of the club that you belong to, as part of the family that you're a part of, for his purposes? You might look at it and compare it sometimes and think, why don't we live where so-and-so lives? Or why aren't our lives like that? Or why aren't my family like theirs? Or why aren't... Could it be that you are where you are by God's foreknowledge, for his purposes, that he's put around you people that he wants you to care for and be responsible for? When that light bulb went on for Lisa and I and our family, we suddenly looked at the street where we live and we thought, this is where we are. let's try and build relationships with the people in this street. So we've done things like street parties and put on Christmas carol events. And I was amazed in London that people want to come out for these things. They love getting to know each other. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, one day in the week, there was a knock on our front door. And Lisa, my wife, was at home on her own. And she opened the front door and there was a young schoolboy stood on the front door. He must have been about 13, 14 years old. And he said to Lisa, could you help me? Now in London, when a schoolboy knocks on your door in the middle of the afternoon, you're generally thinking, I'm amazed he hasn't run away. But you're also thinking, where are the other kids in the front garden? Like they're going to pounce on you. But this boy said to Lisa, would you mind walking me down the street? There's a group of lads down the street and I'm scared to walk past them on my way home. Lisa didn't recognize him to start with, but then suddenly the penny dropped. This was the son of some friends of ours, Helen and Simon, who we got to know as neighbors who lived down the street. And they'd said to their son, 14 years old, they said to him, if you ever feel scared, knock at number two. When I first told that story and when Lisa told it, she had tears running down her face. She was like, we want to get to know our neighbors, but we began to realize, oh my word, this is where God has us. And if we can make a difference for him in this place, that's what he wants us to do. So where are you? Where do you find yourself? What is your frontline context in terms of where you are? Now, immediately, some of us think, oh, well, I'm not really that important. I don't matter. I'm too old to have a front line or whatever. Thelma's 93 years old. Thelma's not quite as fleet of foot as she was when she was 70, but she's 93 now. And she's in a session that we've run, and she hears about this idea of your front line. And she thinks she lives in sheltered accommodation. But she suddenly realizes that most days she takes a little journey down the road to a little shop, a little convenience store run by a family. She suddenly realizes that this is her front line. This is where God has her. Life in many ways has narrowed. She doesn't go as far as she would have done earlier in her life. It doesn't take her to the different places, but she goes to this little shop. So, discovering that this is where God has her and that this is her front line, she starts to pray for the family that run the shop. And surprise, surprise, she starts to get to know them. She starts to discover about their children and that they've got exams coming up. And she says she'll pray for their children. And she builds this wonderful relationship with this family in this convenience shop. This is Thelma's front line at the age of 93. We might not have somebody else's front line, but what's ours? I've heard of people saying, I understand my front line. I now spend my life at this stage of my life. I'm confined mostly to a bed in a care home. But my bed has become an altar. It's my front line. And every time a carer or a visitor comes to where I am, I do my best to try and represent God to them. Those are extreme examples, but I'm trying to say, because I think a lot of people feel like, well, I don't have some exciting front line, but sometimes it's there and we just need to think, what is it, Lord? Where is it that you have me? What is my front line? I wonder what yours is. I wonder how you see that idea. And if you want to know more about that, certainly as an organization, we try to let people or help people understand it. When you think about your front line, you can try and map it out, even in your mind now, to think, who is there? Because sometimes we can live in a place, and it amazes me, and even as Christians, we don't always know our neighbors. Who is there? Who's at the club you go to? Do you rush past them? Have you noticed them? I try to go out from where I live sometimes and just walk, because I live in London, so it's densely populated. I think, so I don't go too far. I think, what's within even a quarter mile radius of the home where I live? Well, there's the local fire station, and I've just discovered there's a new cafe, so I have to go there quite regularly to build relationship and have coffee and pastel donatas on a regular basis. It's a suffering for the cause. But it literally is just around the corner. But then I noticed my neighbours. There's Carol at number one, and Carol's been struggling with cancer for years. There's a young couple who live at number three. They've just moved in, and they've just started to say hello. And I go down the street, and I know most of my neighbours. Sometimes I attempt to go out for, I call it a run. I'm not sure. It's more of a stumble around the block. But anyway, sometimes when I'm coming home, I'll walk up the street, and I'll just commit each neighbour. And just in doing that, you become more present to your front line. I play squash. It's one of the sports I still manage to just about play. And I play with four black cab drivers. They just happen to be available during the week. And that was a huge adjustment for me in terms of being a minister. I had to stop a lunchtime service that we ran in order to make time to go and play squash, because I felt like I need to rediscover a front line and live this out. But it's at the squash club where I remember with Colin, he told us a couple of years ago, he got prostate cancer, and we sat at the back of the court and I prayed for him. But it's not just about, am I praying for him? It's about the way I play the game as well on my front lines, the way I am as a person. I can't tell you the number of times when I get home, I've had to text Peter and say, Peter, I'm so sorry for the way I played today. I lost my cool and it wasn't good, and I've had to apologize. And I tell those stories to my church. We've got to be real about how God is trying to use us in those frontline contexts, because it's where we try and live out what we believe, isn't it? Where we live, where we work, or where we play. Who is there? Who has God put on your radar, under your care, that you need to be aware of? What about our purpose? We'll look at this lastly, and I'll share a bit about this, and then we'll do like we did yesterday. We'll open it up for kind of wisdom sharing, not really Q&A, but I think yesterday was brilliant in terms of people just sharing their perspectives or their thoughts in this season of your life. But now that I'm retiring, or now that I'm approaching retirement, what do I do? People transitioning into this season of life today are hungry to know how they can make use of all that they've learned, both the experiences that they've had, the skills that they've gained, and so on. What is it that I now do? As the title of this session indicates, the question can often be this relationship between whether I view retirement through the lens of vacation or whether I view retirement through the lens of vocation. We can come to retirement and think, now I can go travel, I can just do whatever I like. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having a desire to do those things. But what is God's call upon my life in this moment? What is his call upon my life as a disciple as I enter into this particular season? As a pastor, generally speaking, when someone comes up to me and tells me that they're going on holiday, I don't generally react by saying, oh gosh, let me pray for you, prepare you. We must think about how you're going to grow and how you're going to work with God for his good kingdom purpose. It's not just what I naturally do when somebody comes up to me and tells me they're going on holiday. And so if we view retirement as a vacation, as a stepping down, then no wonder there is a lack of discipling in this moment. It's probably a word we don't necessarily hear or use every day, but when we hear the word vocation, I wonder what it makes us think of. I think we tend with words like vocation, when we think of calling, we tend to think of people that have either been sent as missionaries, they're called, maybe people that are ministers. Maybe there's another level where there are certain types of work that we think of as being called to, whether it's a teacher or somebody who works in a particular service like the police force or healthcare or something like that. But the culture of church, I think, has made a lot of us feel like, I'm not called, am I? The truth is that we are all called, and our callings get expressed in 1,000 different ways. The word vocation comes from the Latin word vocare, which means to call. So the word vocation is about our calling. which presumes there is a caller, someone who calls us to be or to do something. The one who is calling us is none other than God himself. God is calling us. You see, God doesn't just call a small percentage of people to a few narrowly defined roles. He calls all of us in a whole myriad of ways. All sorts of ways in which that calling will get expressed, that God has a call on our lives, whoever you are, wherever you are, and whatever you do. In our society, retirement is normally associated with that other V word, vacation. For many, retirement is merely a time to do what they want to do, to finally enjoy life after many years of hard work. While we might have some great vacations during that time, if health and if finances allow for that, ultimately, our retirement years are a season where we continue to respond to and live out our God-given vocation. I don't know if I've got this quote. Billy Graham said this. Old age has its challenges and is not for wimps. But God wants us to embrace it as part of his plan for our lives and to look for the Lord's purpose in every circumstance and in every face or voice we encounter daily. We are all called. We are all called to steward the earth. It's a funny phrase in some ways, but when Genesis speaks about our calling as God's people, it says in Genesis 1, 26 to 28, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves along the ground. I think that what God is saying to us in that is, I've given you the raw material of life. Go do something with it. Cultivate it. Use it. Multiply it. We're all called to steward the wonderful raw material of creation that God has given to us. And that will get expressed in a thousand different ways. I remember hearing Bishop T.D. Jakes say, God only ever made a tree. He never made a table. I think it's a wonderful picture of how God gives us that raw material and then he encourages us to cultivate it, do something with it. We're all called to do that. We're all called to be disciples of Jesus. It's an obvious thing to say, but we touched on that yesterday, speaking about how that will look different in different seasons and different moments. You're called to try, and we'll say a little bit more about this in a moment, but you're called to attempt to try and display the character of Christ and follow the ways of Christ in your particular context. That's enormously challenging sometimes. I said to you yesterday about a couple in my church, Olive and John, and how John, when he retired, just did not handle the transition well and went into this physically vegetative state, and Olive ended up caring for him for 12 years. That's such a challenge. To live out your wedding vows and love that person through 12 years of care. And she did it so faithfully. She found it so hard. I remember speaking to her. She had tears in her eyes in the front room. She says, Steve, I don't like to admit it, but sometimes, and I thought, this, she's so humble. Sometimes I look out the window and I see couples of our age walking past hand in hand. And I think, I wish that was me. And yet her calling to follow Christ in that moment was to do the really challenging thing of caring daily for her husband. We're all called to belong to the church. Please try and hear that correctly. It's not belonging to the church in the sense of I go to that building and that's the club I belong to, but I belong to God's church. I'm part of his people. And we are called to bring the way of heaven to earth where we are. Your kingdom come. your will be done on earth as in heaven. Your kingdom come, your will be done in Eatonville Road in South London where I live as in heaven. Your kingdom come, your will be done. You name the place, your street, your place of context, your club that you go to. We're all called to belong to a church that seeks to bring the way of heaven, not just tell people about how to get there. You're called to bring the way of heaven to where you live. You're called to try and be a neighbor in such a way that you help your neighborhoods, your people in your neighborhood to flourish. So if there are things in your street going on that you think, this is not good news for my neighbors, for the kids in my street, for the older people in my street, for whoever, well, what are you doing about it? What's going on around you? And we are all called to participate in the mission of God. To love God and to love our neighbor. And again, that will get expressed in a number of different ways. Just want to show us a video. I'm going to show us a little video. We've got this brilliant little series called, we've got a great resource called Fruitfulness on the Frontline. A number of you have come up to me and said you've used it in your churches. But we followed it up and we've created a resource called 6M People. So we have this framework where we try and help people realize that they're probably already making a difference for God. And we talk about how we make a difference for God through modeling godly character to those around us. We try and put into practice the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, and so on, that we model that character to those around us. We make good work. We do the tasks that we're given to do to the best of our ability. To even, like I try at home, I genuinely try at home as a husband, whether I'm asked to hoover or wash up, I try and do it to the glory of God because it's a blessing to my family. We make good work. We minister grace and love to those around us. We live in a world where there's not a lot of that. So just genuine kindness, graciousness, love to those that we meet. I'm throwing this in just to stir your mind. Sometimes even at Christian conferences, it's bizarre to me. Generally, those who are volunteering here, most days when you walk in, they're hello, well, and they're fantastic. There's a great atmosphere. But I sometimes go to churches and places, and sometimes even at Christian conferences, and I've spoken to somebody, and I know them, and I see them again, they don't even say hello. I think, well, what's that about? And I know they might have something else on their mind, but if we can't even get it right amongst our Christian community, what hope have we got out there in the world? We're called to minister grace and love. We're called to mold culture, to try and shape the way things are done around here. We're called to be a mouthpiece for truth and justice, to speak up on behalf of those who can't speak for themselves. And we're called to be messengers of the gospel, I think, in the way that we live and in the way that we speak. I'm just going to show you a film of a guy called Sunil and what this looks like for him in his retirement. We've got a number of these films. They're free to download and use. If you want to use them with your church or personally, you can just get them on our YouTube channel. But let me just show you his story.
Sunil retired a year ago after a career as a psychiatrist. So what do the 6 M's of fruitfulness look like for him? Sunil was praying that in his so-called retirement, God would work through all his training and life experience in new ways. But how? God said, focus on friendships and life coaching. Of course, there were lots of things other people wanted him to do. So modeling godly character required a lot of self-control and gentleness to stay on track. For him, making good work is about nurturing relationships with friends and family, making time to play badminton with his son, and getting beaten ever more comprehensively as the weeks go by. It means preparing really, really well for every client. Sunil ministers grace and love by working hard to help clients discover their real underlying issues. Molding culture means not growing a big client base, as most coaches would, but setting boundaries, just 3 people at a time, even as he seeks to offer his wisdom to a broader audience through writing and podcasts. Being a mouthpiece for truth and justice means that when a client does ask for his opinion, he'll give the biblical answer even if he doesn't quote the verse. As a messenger of the gospel, he makes it clear to clients that if they have no interest in God, then he's probably not the coach for them. Because when you're offering life coaching, questions of meaning and purpose are bound to bubble up. And they do. What does living the six M's of fruitfulness look like for you?
Sunil's story is part of a resource we have called Six M's. It's kind of an addition to Fruitfulness in the Frontline. It's a free on our website. It's got a small group resource that goes alongside it. You can use it. It tells the stories of people in different stages of their life. That just happens to be one from that time of retirement. We have, I was going to take you through those, but in terms of time, we're nearly there. We're just going to open it up in a minute for conversation. But just to share one or two resources that I found helpful in preparing for this. John White's book, The Final App, is a really good one. And Jeff Harnan's book, An Uncommon Guide to Retirement. There's a couple of LICC would say we found that to be one of the best books on retirement that's out there. We have a resource as an organization called Repurpose. It's free. It's six sessions that you can either do on your own or do as a small group. You can download it for free from our website, help you think through this particular season of life. We're going to open it up for, as I say, not really Q&A, but just more, there may be questions, there may be insights you have, wisdom you'd love to share, particularly as we think today about the struggle to kind of, and this transition moment to think about our identity, to think about where we are, our front line, to think about our calling. If you've got things that you want to share with us, Maura will come around with a microphone. We've got a bit of time to share before Maura will close for us. Thank you.
Hi, this is a bit of a follow-on from yesterday, but it also connects with today. We were talking about, well, what's changed? What is the nature of our lives, retirement? So I recently reread a great little book, which is one possible description of retirement in its title. It's a little book called Freedom from the Tyranny of the Urgent. It came out over 20 years ago. It's written by Charles Hummel, who was at one point the executive director of InterVarsity Fellowship. So he'd been a really busy guy. And I guess we've all come across this tension, which occurs at all stages of life, I guess. Well, this is urgent. Yeah, but this is important. And of course, often the two things don't go together. So I'm saying rather too much here. Sorry to ramble on. But this is a great little book. I do have my copy with me. You can't have it, but you're welcome to. I've lent it out to two young guys quite recently, both of whom are about to take on, you know, new extra Christian responsibilities and have been saying to me, well, yeah, but how am I going to manage to do this? How am I going to find the time? And so this is not specifically for retirees, but it's very, very apt and is really helpful in thinking about how we use our time at any stage of life. Great little book, Freedom from the Tyranny of the Urgent. One last thing, not to be confused with his earlier book, simply called The Tyranny of the Urgent, which is not quite so encouraging, but you want this one, Freedom from the Tyranny of the Urgent. I hope that's helpful.
How a writer could milk a topic, that's a great... But that's a really helpful contribution, because I think you're right, that so often in our lives, when we're trying to discern what to do in this season, it's often the difference between deciding between something that's good and something else that's good, isn't it? It's trying to work out what's the right thing to do. More, is somebody just over, gentleman over in the right there?
Thank you for what you've been sharing from the front. Just to pick up on something you mentioned yesterday in terms of what do we have in our hands that we can offer to the Lord. It's easier to talk about the more positive things, the more pleasant experiences we've had. I just want to share that the Lord can also use painful things that we've been through in life. And in fact, he can use those in wonderful ways, in that we're to show comfort as he shows comfort. And with what we've been through in life, he can use us to find ways so that we can walk through others who may be having painful experiences.
That's really helpful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's true in any season of our lives, isn't it, that sometimes our greatest way of serving others comes from our most painful experiences. I know within my family, I've got three brothers, and one of my brothers with his wife, they weren't able to have their own children, But the struggle that they went through and the way in which God can use them with others who are going through that same struggle, you can take that same experience. And when somebody's able to say to you, me too, I've been through that, there's nothing more healing or more helpful when you've got somebody like that coming into your life. And I think God can redeem the tough experiences that we've had in life as well, the hard experiences. That's really helpful. Thank you so much. You've got to run right across, but we're coming over. Lady just here and towards the back. There we go.
Thank you. Again, talking about what's in our hands. Many, many years ago, before I really thought about what I was going to do in retirement, I went to a service and they gave us a hand. And they said, just want you prayerfully to sit and pray what you want to do, what you want to write on that hand. Mm. And I wrote about helping older people. Well, at that situation, no way was I able, and no way did I think I could cope with older people. Anyway, 20 years down the line, I then took over our ladies' meeting, which was mainly older people. And it was only by someone saying, I've got to pass this over. The Lord has told me you are the person. And I thought, no, help. And I took it over. And the Lord has really blessed me. But at the time, it wasn't till even months down the line, I suddenly remembered, oh, what was that hand? And wow. There I had written it.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
It was, yes.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It's brilliant. Brilliant.
I'm going to share that one of the best bits of advice I was given when I retired was book your holidays first. It's surprising how every week gets filled up with meetings, looking after, in my case, godchildren, grandchildren. And if you're retiring next year and you want to come to Keswick next year, book it, because I've done it. I've said, oh, I'm sorry, I was thinking of going to so-and-so. Oh, but you haven't booked it yet. Could you just? And it's very difficult to say no.
That's brilliant.
The other thing is, I once met a lady. I'm a Mother's Union speaker. She was extremely deaf. She was blind. She had lost both legs. And she said, well, I can't see, I can't hear, and I can't walk. But I can pray, so that's what I do.
Wow.
She's an amazing lady.
That's amazing. Thank you. I feel really encouraged that I spent all morning talking about, it's not about vacation, but vocation, but we should book our holidays first. That's exactly. But I hear what you're saying in terms of you've got to set your own rhythm. That's a good tip any stage of life. I'm terrible at doing it, but it's a really good tip. We've got time maybe for one. Yeah, there's a lady right in front of me. I was going to say, I didn't see it. Go for it.
This is really just from yesterday and talking about how we often don't recognise the front lines of the people that we worship with. At our church, we do something once a month, which is an interview with a member of the congregation called This Time Tomorrow, and it helps us pray for what they're involved in.
That's a great practice to bring into your church, this practice of this time tomorrow. You just do simple little interviews, having somebody come to the front, say, where will you be this time tomorrow? I made the mistake of doing it with a student a couple of weeks ago, and I asked her, where will you be this time tomorrow? And she just went, in bed. I was like, right, game over. I went hour by hour. I said, where will you be about 12? Probably still in bed. I think we got to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was like, I might be up by then. It's like, right, what are you doing then? What are you doing then? But you ask them, what are they doing? And you just say, what do you enjoy about that? What are your challenges? How can we pray for you? The way your church will get to know each other, doing a little practice like that is really helpful. Thank you for sharing that. Well, I think we probably should wrap up. So would you come and close for us?
Steve, thank you so much again. I think there's so much to think about and take away, isn't there? And we're really grateful for that and all the materials that we can go away and look at and take time to think through. But let's just pray together. Father, we've all come here this morning from very different circumstances. Some of us may be really fighting where we're at. Some of us may be suffering in the context we're in. Some of us may be joyfully in that place. But Father, I thank you that we are your children. You love us and you have good things for us. And I pray, Father, as we just think through even that idea of context and frontline, that you would help us to intentionally think through where you have placed us, the clubs, the families, the street we're in, the city we're in. And Father, we pray that you would help us to, if we need to, change our mindset or reframe it to see it through your eyes. Father, thank you so much for the time we've had together and just the beginnings of conversations. I pray those would be carried on through the day, that we would really build each other up to, I loved that comment that Steve made about seeking to bring the way of heaven to where we live at this time in our lives. Thank you, Lord. Amen.